I appreciate the comments from Ken about how the public kind of has to deal with, you have to deal with the public sometimes. We're on a dead end road outside of a college town, so we find a lot of empty Bush Light cases scattered outside there. So that sort of happens. My name is Kendall DeYoung. I'm an agricultural engineer with the USDA ARS. And the presentation I'm going to give today is related to the talks that we heard earlier, but I'm going to talk a little more about a little difference in scope and scale in dealing with one particular research station and some of the things that we do and some of the challenges. I'd like to acknowledge my co-author, Tom Trout. He was a research leader at our unit for several years, and he recently retired in January of 2015. Our research site is located near Greeley, Colorado. It's semi-arid, northern Colorado in the Front Range. And what's happening in the Front Range of Colorado, the population is growing very quickly. It's a very nice place to live, and a lot of people are moving there. And what limits a lot of that growth is water resources, not necessarily the land. So a lot of these growing municipalities are purchasing water rights so that they can grow, and obviously that puts a pinch on the farmers and some of the economics in the area. So what we're exploring is ways to try to maintain high crop yields with less water, so do more with less. And our mission really is applicable not only in northern Colorado, but in other places such as western Kansas, northern Texas, you know, where they have declining aquifers, interstate compacts between several states, droughts. The reality is we're trying to figure out how to do more with less. So we're really looking at irrigation management from a management standpoint. We have a couple plant physiologists on staff where we're looking at the plant level to try to understand more on that end, and we're also looking at remote sensing areas. Today we're going to talk about basically an overview of the farm. I'll kind of give you an idea of what things look like on the farm and the data that we collect, some of the buildings and infrastructure that we've built there, and then highlight some of the challenges that we have. And many of these challenges are things that commodity farmers also face, but particularly in the scope of a research project, trying to have those interactions between having quality research and quality agriculture is often a challenge. This is an aerial image of our research farm, and the mouse comes up here. We have a building here, which is fairly new, which we recently built, which is really nice to have. This farm, by the way, has been in ag research for over 100 years. It originally started out as the Colorado State College potato research farm. It's been in and out of either ARS and or Colorado State University research for over 100 years. So we had our centennial a couple years ago. This main plot here is most of what we'll be talking about. We have 96 replicated plots where we rotate crops and have 12 different treatments, 4 replicates of each, where we look at different levels of irrigation management, where we're trying to specifically stress the crops during vegetative and reproductive growth stages. This plot here has a Bowen ratio energy balance system, so we try to keep that somewhat homogeneous. We often get the question, how much fetch do you have? And the answer is always not enough. You can see this radar bubble here, the Death Star, as we often refer to it. I'll tell you a little bit more about how that affects our research. Here's our plot map, and as I said, we have 96 different plots, typically split into 2 different crops, 4 replicates of each. So, for example, treatment 1 would be 100% of ET throughout the entire season. We base everything on crop evapotranspiration and scale it down from that. So, for example, a treatment 5 would be 80-50. So we try to reach 80% of maximum ET during the vegetative growth and 50% during the maturation growth phase. During tasseling and sensitive growth stages, we give it as much water as it will take because obviously you take a huge hit in yield during that time. Most of our irrigation application is on drip. We have surface drip and subsurface drip. It's not necessarily because we advocate drip for production, but because we are in the business and the research of quantifying water use very accurately. So you can see we do have some subsurface drip, so this is what it looks like when it's just coming to the surface, and then most of our drip lines that are on the surface run right next to the crop, minimizing some of the surface evaporation that you get. Once you get full canopy cover, that matters a lot less. We count our water very accurately. You can see this is a manifold for our main system, so it will come up through the ground. If we tell it to irrigate, it will activate the solenoid, and it goes through a flow meter. Once the flow meter has the amount that going through that meter that we desire, it will shut off the solenoid. And so we are very, very accurate in how we count that. Sometimes, you know, you have issues that come up. You have to be foolproof. If you have a bad leak at the end, for example, that can happen. Sometimes you have electrical issues, but I would say 95% of the time this works the way it's supposed to, and it's a very, very nice system. We have everything connected with Campbell Scientific data loggers and controls. We have this set up so that we can, we have to use a computer of some type to set up the irrigation. We can do this remotely from our office in Fort Collins. I'll talk a little more about this later, but our office is about 40 miles from our field site. So having the ability to turn that on and off or at least adjust is a nice thing to have, especially when you turn on water and then you have a rainstorm come about halfway through your irrigation. It's nice to shut it off. That's one of the practical things that I'll talk a little more about later. We are working on getting this so that we can turn things on and off with our phones. We're getting close to that. Smartphone technology is really nice. We have an on-site coagmat station, much like the set of stations that were shown in Utah. There are about 55 stations throughout the state of Colorado that give reference ET. It's on a well-watered reference crop, and we use that reference ET with crop coefficients to try to determine what our crop ET is on a daily basis. We also track our water use with soil moisture. This is a neutron moisture meter or neutron probe. We have one of these tubes in each of our 96 plots. We take the data at six different soil layers, probably three times a week. It's a very repetitive and arduous task that we often hire undergraduates or graduate students to do. They read a lot of books on tape and listen to a lot of music, but it's a tremendous data set. We found that neutron probe is one of the better measurements, indirect measurements of soil water content that you can get. And while it does take a lot of work, if you can get boots on the ground and get that data several times a week, it's really nice to have. Most of our plots are 12 rows wide and about 140 feet long. We try to take all of our measurements from the middle, including our harvest. We will hand harvest. This is an example photo of the hand harvest of sunflower. So we'll hand harvest, put into these buckets that you see on the bottom, and then we'll run it through a thresher, bag them, weigh them for moisture, and then we'll bulk out the rest of it. As I mentioned, we do have two plant physiologists on staff, so some of the measurements that we take are more plant-based. For example, sap flow is an interesting technology where there is a heat pulse that goes into the plant, and you measure the change in the heat at a higher level on the plant, and as the plant transpires, you can have an indirect measurement of transpiration of the plant. We're also measuring hydraulic conductance of the plant, dye perfusion, several other physiological measurements. Also looking at root growth, we have many rhizotron tubes, which are glass acrylic tubes that go into the ground and basically makes a window within the ground at an angle. And you can send a camera down there 1 centimeter increments at a time and take pictures in the ground throughout the season. And so you can see how that changes throughout the depth and throughout time. It also requires students to look at these images and trace them on a computer, which is also a task that's takes a lot of time and a lot of work, but it really can yield some interesting data in the end. In most of our plots, we've been using infrared thermometers for quite a long time. As you have a crop go into stress, it will slow transpiration, the leaves will wilt, and it basically increases in temperature. So we're using that temperature as a proxy to try to quantify water stress and ET reduction. And so we have a tremendous set that's a diurnal data set where we take samples every 5 seconds and it averages every 15 minutes, and we have this in probably 3/4 of our plots. So it's a real nice data set as well. We published several papers from that. This is a Hi-Boy tractor that has been customized to take ground-based remote sensing samples. As far as I know, this system is a one of a kind. It was custom built by one of my predecessors, Walter Bausch. It has a boom that extends over the adjacent field and takes nadir images from the top. You can see this is what we have on the boom, or what we had at one point. Everything's GPS referenced. We have infrared thermal cameras, leveling, self-leveling, RGB cameras, infrared cameras. Now we have multispectral sensors. I think this summer we had about $100,000 worth of sensors sitting on that boom as we would go through. And it's really interesting talking to the manufacturers when you try to tell them what you're doing with their equipment. They said, so you're hanging this off of a tractor and you're driving it through the field. Is it going to be hot? Yes. Is it going to be dusty? Yes. Are you sure you want to buy this $25,000 camera and hang it from a tractor? So, you know, we have some issues with that. Most of the time things work pretty well, but, you know, when things overheat and things shake and, you know, there are some issues with that. We're in the process of phasing this out with UAV technology becoming, you know, more in line, more affordable. We're hoping to get a UAV off the ground so we can essentially do the same thing without having compaction of our soils and without having to drive the tractor through the field. But this has been a really neat opportunity to get a lot of neat data. Here's an example of some of the thermal data that we can get. So we have this is corn, a thermal image of corn under full and limited irrigation, and you can see the histogram. The corn that's under full irrigation is cooler. Under limited irrigation, it's warmer, and you can kind of see that interaction of the distributions, and that's because what you see here is a lot of soil background, and so you're getting a lot of hot soil background. In fact, you can see a drip line right here, that horizontal piece. So we're working on algorithms to process these data sets so that we can quantify water stress using these images as well. A lot of what you see in satellite images is a much larger, broader scale, you know. So we're looking at the plant level and trying to scale between those differences. We have improved our facilities. When I first was out there, I was getting my PhD at Colorado State, and these were our facilities. We had a storage container that was our office and shop, and we had a port-a-john. These are our new facilities. We actually built a building out there, and this land is currently owned by Colorado State University, but we have a long-term lease with them, and we collaborate very closely with them, so we feel comfortable putting in infrastructure and buildings and such, and it's been a really nice change for us to have some room to store equipment and have a real restroom. And so here's some of the equipment that we store inside, and there's an office and a restroom underneath. It also is a nice place for us to host field days. We host an annual field day, typically have between 50 and 80 stakeholders come by. So it's a real nice opportunity. We give a lot of tours of the facility. In conjunction with local conferences or anytime anybody wants a tour. So if you find yourself in northern Colorado and you'd like a tour, please contact me. I'd be happy to show you around. Now, getting into some of the logistics of what we do, in you know, farming in general is very difficult. I grew up on an irrigated farm, and even that alone, it's you have things that have to happen in a certain order, and Mother Nature has to cooperate in many different ways, and it's a challenge. When you have research going on at the same time, you're trying to interact all of these things, and often the order that things happen can create difficulties. So You know, right now we're talking about tillage and what we need to do over the winter to prep the field. We'll do some soil sampling, some nitrogen sampling in the off season. And these are in order as you go down. In the spring, we'll do some spraying, try to spray things off before we plant. Once we have emergence, then we can start doing other things. We are semi-arid in the spring. Sometimes we don't have enough moisture in the upper soil profile to get germination. So sometimes we will put out sprinklers with our system, which takes quite a bit of work to do, but we do have that option. We also will install neutron probes, mini rhizotrons, sap flow equipment. Those are things that we all do once we have emergence, because if you have bad sand in an area, you don't want to install a neutron probe where you're measuring soil moisture. So you kind of have to wait for that to happen. We might spray again post-emergence, and once again, if you look at the sap flow equipment, has some equipment that's higher up in the ground, and it has solar power coming to it on towers, and so you really can't drive over that with a sprayer. So there has to be a lot of communication on that end. We install a lot of our irrigation systems by hand, especially surface systems. We have to drag out the tubing and connect it, and so that takes a crew several days, next to a week. And we will irrigate, fertigate, soil moisture, remote sensing, IRTs, all of these data systems that we collect, they all kind of go on at the same time. And my square did not end up where I wanted it to, but I was trying to circle. This is the bulk within this, besides harvest. This is the bulk of what we do. It's kind of a rinse and repeat cycle. We will take soil moisture. We might irrigate that same day after we do soil moisture. And you don't want to irrigate until after you're done collecting soil moisture. We might run that tractor through the field. You don't want to do that on the same day when somebody else is sampling in the same area. So it takes a lot of communication between all of the scientists and all of the staff to try to manage how this works. In the end, we'll pick up the irrigation and we'll do a bulk harvest. This is very difficult to read, and I understand this, but this is a close-up of one of our plots. And you can see rows 1 through 12 on the top outlined. This is how we have to organize what we do. So the shaded areas inside here, for example, will be yield areas. Any other measurements that we have to take, we have to consider where is foot traffic, where is the tractor traffic. For example, these vertical lines here are the tractor tires for the high boy reflective tractor that drives through. We don't want any students taking any samples anywhere near those rows, because you get, 10-foot tall corn. You don't want anybody standing in that row where you're going to run through. So those rows between rows 1 and 2 and 10 and 11, it's a strict no-no to everybody. Do not ever walk through those rows, because if we're driving a tractor, we don't want to have an accident. I mean, safety is an ultimate concern. We try to take all of our measurements within the middle four rows. We have biomass areas that we take periodically throughout the season. You don't want to take those biomass areas anywhere close to your yield areas, because you don't want that to affect the outcome of the yield overall or the water balance or anything else. And when you have several scientists working on the same project, it's fantastic because we have overlapping sets of data. It's also a challenge because you have a limited amount of space, and so it takes a lot of collaboration. One challenge that we get, it's in a dry area, but sometimes we get wet springs. And so if we want to stress the crop right off the bat, we don't want to irrigate. We side dress our nitrogen during planting, but we also fertigate, and so we will inject nitrogen directly into the irrigation line. We try to make every treatment so that it is not nitrogen deficient. So, in other words, if we want to get nitrogen on it, we have to irrigate. But that's a conundrum, because if it's already wet, we don't want to give it more water. So that creates some issues, and it creates some tricky irrigation scheduling methods to try to make that happen on occasion. We've really struggled with sunflowers, especially sunflowers following corn. Sunflowers are planted very shallow, and they require the right amount of moisture to germinate, and they're very picky. So you get some issues in with germination. This is what it can look like from above. You get a lot of skips. So if you're taking remotely sensed images on a small scale, that obviously can affect some of your results. So consequently, sometimes we have to throw out some of these data sets. We have issues with herbicide resistance. The kochia in the area has figured out Roundup, and it's a problem. It's a huge problem. You can see where we sprayed some of it off here in the middle, and then as everything grew up, we even tried a hood sprayer to knock it down and still had terrible, terrible issues with the kochia. Consequently, we've abandoned sunflowers. Corn seems to do better because it kind of gets up above the canopy a lot quicker, but herbicide resistance is a huge issue, not just for us. I mean, it's getting that way for farmers all over the place. Hail can be an issue. Hail can happen in a lot of places, but you can see we got a pretty good hail storm the night before this picture was taken. This is sunflowers. This plant would probably be okay. The one in the middle would probably be okay. When it knocks off that other leaf, that plant will probably die. We got a pretty easy or pretty early hail storm one year and really had a lot of stand issues because we had the storm at the wrong time. Now, corn, you get a hail storm at that time with corn. This was the same storm. It'll come out of it. It does okay as long as you don't get hail during tasseling. This is a hail storm we got this year. You can see corn and sunflower. This is a before picture. This is an after picture. We lost 50% of our canopy cover. We haven't found out whether we took a huge hit in yield, but I would guess probably a 30% cut in yield. That happens. I mean, that's a reality. We also have issues with birds, as they did in Utah. These birds would sit up on the power line and roost and eat all of our sunflowers, so we put nets over them to try to prevent that from happening. And then we got a huge snowstorm before harvest. So, you know, you win some, you lose some, I guess. But that was a huge issue, a real wet, you know, early snowstorm. We've gotten early frost before. Every field that was in corn in this area, I actually took a plane ride to take photos the 2 days after the frost. And so everything that's gray in here was corn. It just fried the corn. Everything that's green in here was sunflower or some other crop. And it was pretty amazing how it really took care of it. With deficit irrigation of corn, you get a lot of blowdown. That can be an issue. And that's a practical agronomic limitation. We've had a lot of turnover in our staff. Thankfully, they took a lot of pictures of what's underground, because without that, we really have no idea. We had to re-randomize our experiment, so we had to dig all of this up and do some plumbing. Okay, never again. That was a challenge, too. And so, you know, sometimes the research makes some of these things pretty difficult. We put in a subsurface drip system. We got tired of putting it on the surface, and so this took a lot of work from our students and staff. It was a fun project, but it took a lot of work. But now it's nice that we have an automated subsurface system. We do have natural gas underneath our fields, and CSU wants to take advantage of that. So sometimes we have heavy equipment running our fields, and consequently we've had to abandon fields because of the compaction. Anytime we till under that compaction, we hit our subsurface drip lines and we have leaks, and so that can be an issue. This last one is about the Death Star that you can see. It's a radar research facility through CSU, and it has this antenna in there that will rotate and collect data, and it messes up our GPS. And as you can imagine, with a custom system like ours, everything is GPSed in, our planning, our tillage, everything. So you'll be driving the tractor along, and it will think that it's on the line, and it will start wandering like it had been at the bar for 5 hours. And so that can really be an issue, and that really affects the rest of our field. As you can also see, we're next to the Greeley Airport, which creates some issues, trying to get UAVs off the ground. One issue that I foresee happening in the future is that we're quite a ways from our research sites, about a 45-minute drive. As population increases, I expect that to become more and more difficult. Construction makes it bad enough already, but it's going to really become a challenge. Staffing has been an issue for us, too, and it, as it is with most people. Our entire staff has turned over in the last 4 years, except for our farm manager. All the scientists, all the technicians, all the support staff. I turned 36 in 2 days, and I am second to senior in our unit. So it's really been a challenge for us to come up to speed, but we've done pretty well. Here's a list of our scientists, and I really want to acknowledge our undergraduate and graduate students that help us out. Without the boots on the ground, it would be impossible to collect the tremendous data sets that we have, and so please acknowledge those people when they help you out. I think I'm about out of time. Thank you, and if you do have questions, please shoot me an email or talk to me now.
Well, if you have a question now, we're at the end of our session, so.
It seemed like you're changing your experimental design fairly often. Is that the case? So what is the system? And the other thing I'm wondering about is, if you've been taking crop cultivation measurements for so long, how stable have they been over the last 20 or 30 years, particularly with the subsurface?
Sure. The first question, how often do we change our research experiment? We run on 5-year cycles, and so it will change every 5 years. We are in the process right now of starting a new project, so we'll start a new one next year. Things change a little bit here and there. For example, this Bowen ratio field that used to be completely homogeneous, with the new subsurface drip system on that, we're able to section that off, and so now we're going to start new sub-experiments on that. We try not to change too much at a time because there's a lot of infrastructure there, and just like any project that gets written, there's probably more promise than what we have the capability of doing. We're getting crunched on staffing too. We're told that we spend too much money on staff. Well, if we have to get rid of staff, we're not going to collect the data sets that we have. So the other question on crop coefficients, maybe we can talk afterwards.
Okay. Kimbo, big hand. Thank you. Again, speakers, just remind you to send me your receipts. But also, I want to make just a few comments. Kendall mentioned undergraduates several times, and some of you speakers mentioned that what does the general public want a university to do is undergraduate education. You can't not emphasize the importance of hands-on, get this experience in the field that's so important for their education. A lot of folks talk about, well, we don't need bricks and mortar schools in universities in anymore. We can do it online. You can't not have this hands-on. That's so important for the education. Another thing, I'm relatively new in a new position. I came from the plant sciences division, and we tooted our own horn really good. I thought we were probably number one in the nation. We were 14 in the nation. But in my new in my new role in the whole experiment station, I get to work with the animal scientists. Ken, did you come from the animal sciences? Well, I found out that our reproductive biology is one of the best in the nation. And they never told anybody about it. I've been at the University of Missouri for 29 years and didn't know that. So we do a very, very poor job of tooting our own horn. And we've got to do a better job with that. So I think that's some of our challenges, that what we have is educate the general public. In Missouri, we have 6 million people. 5.8 million don't care about where the food comes from. We've got to educate them on that. But how do we do that? And also, our stakeholders out there too. It's a fine line. So we have our challenges out here, don't we? Well, thank you all for coming, and this concludes this session. Thank you.